Ari, thank you so much. Gemara recommends one be posech b'chvod achsanya to open speaking by thanking the hosts, and we have two. I want to obviously thank B'nai Shurin for graciously opening many, many rooms of their facility to enable this conference. And I want to thank Yeshiva Dakota, particularly Reuven Tarragon, and his entire staff, both in Israel and here in America, for the tens, if not hundreds, of hours of work that went into organizing this. And Mr. Shem, it will serve the conference as a whole, will serve to move forward all of us as members of family, as members of schools, as members of communities, in the chinuch of ourselves and of our children. And I want to begin by recognizing the presence of two educators who, over the course of decades of work, touched the lives of many hundreds of young men of our community and many thousands of young men and women of the general American community. I'm privileged and proud that my parents are here, and I hope you will enjoy. I want to begin with a story. I don't know if this story ever took place, but as we'll see, that might not really matter. I want you to imagine for a moment the following. Close your eyes and imagine a tzitzis party. 3-year-old boy, he's ready to put on tzitzis for the first time. The family gathers, and we have a party, we have the cake, and we have the little size 3 tzitzis with the puff paint picture of the mitzvah train, whatever appropriate picture you have on the tzitzis. And he puts on the tzitzis for the first time, he makes a bracha, everyone claps, everyone's so happy to see this young boy wearing the size 3 tzitzis. And it is something to celebrate. But if the young boy is no longer so young, fast forward a couple of decades, now he's 13, 23, 53, or 83, still wearing the size 3 tzitzis, which by now is choking him around the neck, it's rather obvious that there's nothing at that point to celebrate. Because it's obvious to us that the physical aspects of our avos Hashem, whether we're men or women, the physical aspects of our avos Hashem need to grow with us as we mature. It's less obvious, but far more critical. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky noted that the intellectual and the emotional and the spiritual aspects of our avos Hashem need to grow with us, and they need to become more sophisticated as we grow older. And so often if one has had the blessing of exposure to concepts of yadus at a young age, so one can fall into the danger of staying with that. When I was 5 and introduced to Avraham Avinu for the first time, I had an age-appropriate 5-year-old's understanding of Avraham Avinu. And I had that 7-year-old's understanding of Shmoneh Esrei and the 6-year-old's understanding of the Purim story, which are all appropriate at that age. But what this Rabbi Yaakov reminds us is that Yadus has to grow with us. Yadus was not only given, Bereishis were not only written for 5-year-olds. And Megillas Esther was not only written for 6-year-olds. And we have the responsibility for ourselves and for those around us to make sure that our appreciation of the concepts of Yadus remain age-appropriate and deepen with us as we deepen. And the value of continuing to work on understanding, not only doing. And I think this is really encapsulated in David HaMelech's charge to his son Shlomo. In the 20th chapter of Divrei Yom Aleph, David HaMelech turns to his son Shlomo near the end of David's life and says, Da'as Elokei Avicha ve'avdehu b'leiv shalem b'v'nefesh chafetza. Da'as Elokei Avicha, know the God of your fathers. Which both Radak al-Atar and the Chovas Halvavos in the first, third chapter of his opening section tell us means that there's a need for a blend. Elokei Avicha, the God of my father. He's a God of my Masorah, God of tradition. But at the same time, I need to strive to move beyond merely accepting God because of tradition. That's the bedrock on which everything rests. But ideally, I'm going to take the next step and das elokei avicha. I'll grow to know, to inquire, to appreciate on my own, to understand to the extent that I can. And from that blend of respect and acceptance of the authority of Masorah, together with the results of my own attempts to understand more, from that blend will flow the second half, what David tells Shlomo, Avdei b'leiv shalem u'nefesh chafetza. It will result in the outcome of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu wholeheartedly and serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu with desire. You know, kids love asking questions. Kids naturally love asking questions at every age. They love asking about things that are sublime and things that are trivial, things that sometimes seem absurd. They love asking all sorts of things about events, about the meaning of things, situations, sexuality. Sometimes kids even ask directly about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's incredibly important to respond to children's answers, children's questions every age. It's not important, and sometimes we have anxiety about having the answer. It's not important to always have the answer in my back pocket, but it is incredibly important to be ready to respond well. And that's what I want to talk about. What are the ingredients to go into responding well? And in order to get to that, let's take a break for a moment, and let's shift our attention for the next couple of minutes from questions to mashal, from questions to metaphor. So much of our tradition and the ideas and the themes and the philosophy of our tradition is dressed in metaphor. Gemara is full of mashal. Much of the Agada, much of the philosophical part of our Talmud, the meaning and the themes of Talmud are dressed in metaphor. And the truth is, as Ryer Kaplan points out in several of his works, the Chacham of the Gemara took their lead from HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, because so much of Tanakh, so much of prophecy, so much of Nevuah, are ideas, sophisticated ideas, presented via metaphor. You know, the Rambam has in the introduction to the last chapter of Sanhedrin, so he has a digression, and he gets a little conversational, talks about a couple of basic elements that build our faith. And one of the conversations that he has in his introduction to Perek Chelek, to the last chapter of Sanhedrin, he says, you know, when we look at agadic statements in Gemara, there are three ways of looking at them. Sometimes we take a look at an agadic statement, and oftentimes they sound a little fantastic. And some will take it all at face value and say, well, if Chazal said it must be exactly literally as meant, and that's it. And he says, that's a shame, Rambam says, because you're robbing the words of Chazal, their sophistication. You're flattening it. Sometimes, he says, option number two, this is even worse, is to similarly understand everything at face value and to, as a result, scorn it for being shallow and unsophisticated. And that, obviously, he says, is even worse. And then he says, you know, there's group three, Rambam says, he's not sure how many partners he has in group three who understand that if Chazal, that we're dealing with incredibly brilliant and deeply spiritual people. And if they said something, they must have had a lot of meaning they were trying to convey. And we need to dig, and we have to be ready to work hard to figure it out. I'll give you an example. The Gemara Masechet Shabbos Daf Peches Amud Aleph, a very, perhaps one of the most famous Agadas in all of Shas. Chumash describes the Jews come to Har Sinai, and the terminology in Chumash is a little bit awkward. They stood at the tachtis of the har. Now, literally, it means they stood at the foothills. That's the pshush hamikra. But the language tachtis almost sounds like they were not next to, but underneath. So Gemara comments, Shabbos Daf Peches, God must have held the mountain over their heads. It must have been under the mountain. How could it be under the mountain? God must have held the mountain over their heads and said, you'll accept Torah or else. So what does that mean? So when we come across that Gemara as a 5-year-old, as a 6-year-old, as a 7-year-old, so we ought to have an appropriately 5, 6, 7-year-old understanding that, you know, that image. What does the image mean? So certainly it's possible that that is literally what happened, that Kadosh Baruch Hu actually uprooted Har Sinai, held it over our heads. And the Rambam reminds us that belief in God as a creator of the universe means that God could do any miracle that he wants to. But we see from the Tanakh that God only does miracles sparingly. Though certainly it's possible if he held it over their heads literally. Maral suggests, though, that this is a mashal. Maral suggests that it actually means something far more powerful than just holding the mountain over their heads. Maral suggests what that means is they had a moment of clarity. It was like this lightning bolt in the middle of the stormy night, when for a moment, everything was so clear. And in that moment, they understood that life would be meaningless without a life of Torah. They understood life for themselves, life for the Jewish people, and the universe would lack meaning. It just made no sense to not accept Torah. They were much more powerfully than the gun to their heads, the mountain over their heads. They were forced They understood they could not do anything. It made no sense to do anything but to accept the Torah. So they were forced, but forced in a much more powerful way than a mountain over their heads. The mountain over their heads, actually, according to Maharal, is a mashal, much as the other mashal I just gave. I said God put a gun to their heads. Right now, obviously, no one thinks that God literally put a gun to the heads of the Jewish people. But we use that as metaphor to say that God forced them. So Maharal suggests, in much the same way, mountain over their heads, like gun to their heads, is a metaphor. And it's actually a metaphor to convey something much more powerful. A much more powerful statement, a much more sophisticated concept, and a much more powerful statement about the force with which HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It wasn't something external or incidental. God happened to say, well, you better or else. They understood that He gave them to understand that they needed this. And let's consider that. Now let's take that as a case study for a moment. Now let's look at that mashal. If one understands, again, there's legitimate machlokas, or whether to take that comment of Chazal, Vayisatsu b'tachta sahar, as a literal statement or as mashal. But let's take the approach that's mashal, the approach of the Maharal. You know, sometimes people misuse the term mashal. You misuse the term metaphor or allegory, and someone comes up being dismissive. Oh, it's just allegory, as though if it's allegory, it need mean nothing. That's myth. Myth means nothing. Allegory is full of meaning. If I say, let's give a simple example for a moment. If I say, don't spill the beans. Right? Did you spill the beans? He says, no. Now, if in fact, obviously what I meant was don't divulge confidential information. Right? So did I spill the beans or not? Well, that's a statement that doesn't mean, that's not meaningless. Either I did or I didn't. Either I divulged confidential information, did I let the secret leak, or did I keep my mouth shut? If I say I didn't spill the beans, oh, it's just metaphor. Yeah, it's metaphor, but it means something. I'm making a verifiable or falsifiable statement. Now, the fact that I didn't take the chalent and throw it on the floor has nothing to do with whether I spilled the beans or not. Because obviously when one's dealing with metaphor, when one's dealing with mashal, truth or falsity doesn't have to do with the mashal, it has to do with the nimshal. Not the literal meaning of the words, but the message that's actually being conveyed. So mashal is not at all dismissive. Oh, it's just a mashal. No, if I say, did you spill the beans? I say, I didn't spill the beans. It actually means something probably far more important than whether the kitchen floor needs mopping or not. I'm talking about whether that information has remained confidential or whether now we have a far larger problem to, quote-unquote, mop up. So when we talk about an agada in a Gemara, for instance, Kaf aleihem harkei gigas, holding the mountain over their heads, putting a gun to their heads. What we talk about that is when I say that agalata that Rashi perhaps quotes, that the Gemara has, that's a mashal that is not in the slightest dismissive. And it's always heartbreaking to hear people say, oh, it's just mashal. To the contrary, Ram points out, it's mashal. It actually conveys far more sophisticated meaning than the literal, flat reading, superficial reading of the words might indicate. It does mean at the same time that the literal meaning of the words, if something is mashal, the literal meaning of the words carries less significance. Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, one of the great Italian Jewish thinkers of the early 1700s, author of well over 100 works, most famously author of Mesillas Yesharim, which we'll get to in a moment. So he has this brief, fascinating essay on Agada, where he writes, in classic Neo-Maimonidean style, he classifies and subclassifies, and he talks about different agadas, and some are literal and some are metaphoric, and what their objectives are. And he says, you know, Chazal enjoyed, as did the Nevi'im, conveying ideas through metaphor. And they used whatever information at hand to talk about what it was that they wanted to discuss. And he says, Chazal had a particular affinity for science. They were not scientists in the sense that study of science was not their primary objective, but they valued it, and they enjoyed using it, Ramchal writes, as one of their most common go-to sources for the material of the mashal, the tool to convey what spiritual message they were trying to convey. But he writes, when Chazal used a scientific statement about the sun, the moon, and the stars as a way of conveying a certain idea, they don't. It matters to them not at all whether the science is true or not. He says, had they lived in a different century, they would use the science of that age, because they weren't trying to talk about science, they were trying to talk about some spiritual or ethical religious message. The science was just a handy tool. So to give, a simple example, they said, put a gun to their heads, right, as a mashal, or spill the beans. Those would work just as well if guns did not exist. Or if in fact there's no such thing as beans, it doesn't really matter. As long as you know what spilling the beans is supposed to indicate, it doesn't really matter whether beans are spillable. As a matter of fact, if guns were outlawed successfully, again, not discussing politics now, but if guns ceased to exist, but people still knew what that meant, like you can use mashalim that may relate back to record players, right? Even though record players are largely a thing of the past. But if the mashal still conveys its meaning, I don't care about what the terminology is. So that's an incredibly important point. And I'll close our discussion of mashal and agada with one final point. In addition to recognizing that when the Nevi'im and when the Chachmei HaTalmud use metaphor, that actually speaks to greater sophistication and greater meaning and a need for greater work to get at the truth value of what's being said. It's true as well in non-metaphoric agadic statements. So let me give you one simple example of the ways in which we sometimes sort of pass things over instead of appreciating their significance. Gemara at the bottom of Daf Hei Amud Aleph Maseches Mokatan, quoted by the Ramchal, Moshe Chaim Lutzata, in the beginning of his Mesil Sisharim. Gemara is talking about, quotes the Pasuk in the 50th chapter of Tehillim, and makes the following statements. Again, Mokatan Hei Amud Aleph. Kol Hasham Archosa Ba'olam Hazeh, if a person self-assesses his paths, which Ramchal understands to mean if a person deliberates over decisions in life, you don't just sort of willy-nilly go do whatever, but you think about things in advance of engaging. Decisions are made thoughtfully from a place of contemplation, which for Ramchal is the first step in any serious program of self-improvement. Kol Hasham Archosa Ba'ol Mazeh, the Gemara tells us, if I make decisions thoughtfully, Zoche V'roa B'Yeshua Shekosh Baruch Hu. So I'll merit seeing God's help. That's the Gemara. Gemara derives that from Pasuk in the 50th chapter of Tom. Now, Moed Katam, the bottom of Hei Amud Aleph. Now, so you look at that Gemara, and I think the way we usually think about those statements is, oh, what did the Gemara say? The Gemara said that it's a good idea that Shamar Chos Bo Mazeh, thinking before acting, that's a good thing. And what was that second half about seeing the salvation of God? Oh, no, I meant, it's a good thing. We tend to sort of flatten the words of Chazal, especially in Agadic context, more than Halachic context. But the Ramchal, beautifully, and it's so subtle, he conveys the subtlety of that, the nuance of that Agada in nuance of his own. Because in fact, if you actually open Mesil Susharim, you'll see that he doesn't make a big deal what he's doing, but it's an object lesson in how to read Chazal. He says, you know what that second half means? God, they didn't just say, oh, it's a good thing, or I raise that tzaddik, or ben olam haba. They said, you'll be zoche to God's assistance. He says, you know, the Gemara is actually telling you two things. Number one, the importance of step one. Step one in any program of self-improvement is to live a contemplative life, to live life thoughtfully. And the other element is zoche, that in itself doesn't guarantee success. The Gemara didn't say, Shamar Chos Ba'al Mazeh, you're on the quick road, you will be a Ben Olam Haba. The Gemara said, Shamar Chos Ba'al Mazeh, you'll merit the other ingredient, Yeshua Shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ramchal said the truth is, our efforts alone, says Yetzirah is so strong, God created the human psyche such that it's incredibly difficult to succeed. The cards are stacked against us. It's really hard, Ba'al Mazeh is really challenging. It's really difficult to succeed against Yetzirah. That's the way God created the system. But if we do our part, it doesn't guarantee success. We do our part, then the Kadosh Baruch Hu will give us the assist. Kol Hashom Archos Ba'al Mazeh, if we do step one, not just you'll succeed, Zoche V'ro B'Yishua Shel Kadosh Baruch Hu, then you'll merit God's Siyata D'Shemaya, which together can bring success. So just again, aside from the content of that Agadah itself, it's an important example in the need to read with nuance, and the need to appreciate the sophistication of Chazal. And now let's bring it back. So with a renewed appreciation for the sophistication and nuance of our Masorah, and of the ideas, not only of the mitzvahs, but the ideas that lie behind the mitzvahs, and the themes that underpin our religion, and renewed pride in the themes and ideas of our religion, and the chain of Chachamim who conveyed those ideas to us. So let's come back to questions. Let's spend the next 10 minutes or so talking about questions, and after that I'll be at the questions. Now, it's incredibly important to have a conversation. It's incredibly important to not only to respond to questions, it's incredibly important to proactively find opportunities to talk about Kaddish Baruch Hu as well, something that Meir Tversky and others have reminded us about repeatedly, that in whatever context you operate, whether you operate at home with children, or you're operating in school with children, you're operating in the community with the people around you, it's incredibly important to take responsibility for proactively bringing a Kaddish Baruch Hu into the conversation. Whether it's in discussing what may otherwise seem like quote-unquote mundane or secular events or context, whether it's even, ironically, in the context of teaching Torah and discussing mitzvahs. I've always thought it ironic that while there may have been constitutional issues for the last couple of decades about God in public school classroom, it always struck me as ironic that God seems to be insufficiently present in the Jewish classroom as well. And how often we may teach not only Vayikra, but even Bereishis, without reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We focus on content without looking at context. And it's so important, and when one habituates oneself to it, it's so easy to talk about ideas in the context of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Not just you need, teaching halacha is not you need to do X. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects of us to do X. And you may even want to add, HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects of us to do X because he wants us to grow into Y. For instance, you take a look, Hilchos Mezuzah in the Rambam. So he gives you all the nitty-gritty important details. And then he says at the end, beautiful, the last halacha in Perek Vav. Rambam says, takes a step back, says, let's look at the bigger picture. What's the philosophy of the halacha? To use the terminology that the Rav Soloveitchik was so fond of. After looking at the details of the halacha, take a step back, what are the larger religious, moral, ethical principles that derive from this? He says, that mezuzah on the wall, you know what it does? It converts the most banal activity, walking from place to place, into an opportunity to come face to face with basics of our religion. Rambam writes. It converts walking through a doorway into opportunity to think about the existence of God who runs the world, who loves us, who wants us to love him, and who has expectations for how we're going to live our lives. You do that on a 1 out of 10 times you notice the mezuzah, 1 out of 10 times you notice it, you think about it, it's a game changer, it's a life changer. That's a very different way to teach. Now 98.9% perhaps of the content of teaching Hilchos Mezuzah is going to be the same. They'll all be transformed through that contextualizing. And it can happen at home at least as much as it happens in the classroom. No one should expect the other partner to take ownership for this. You need to take ownership wherever you lie on this, or if you're both parent and a teacher. But wherever, in whatever context you operate, you need to take responsibility for maximizing. There are so many opportunities. And talk about events as well, not obviously overtly religious events. To talk about life in the context of emuna. Talk about life in the context of bitachon. And it need not be, and it should not be long lectures. It's the same sentence, but with recast. It's the same paragraph, but recast, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu is putting HaKadosh Baruch Hu into the conversation. Discussing the emunah we have in our minds, it's not going to be conveyed unless we see to it that we convey it. Rabbi Tversky will speak at the closing keynote. I imagine he will touch on a line that he's had in the past, and it's incredibly important. He's Rabbi Dr. Abraham Tversky has said a number of times that once upon a time, to raise children of Erech HaYidin, it was enough for the parents to be Shulchan Aruch Jews. Because nowadays, just to make that basic bar, it's insufficient for parents to be Shulchan Aruch Jews. It's insufficient just to do what you're supposed to do. Parents need to be Mesilas Yesharim Jews. Parents need to be actively engaged in thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Actively engaged in seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our lives, seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our goals, seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our responsibilities and our expectations, and to convey that. And this sort of conveyance, both proactively, finding opportunities to inject HaKadosh Baruch Hu into the conversation, and reactively, when questions come up, to respond. So how do we respond? So I think the first recipe to successful response, and this will come over time, is when the response is coming from a place of pride. When there's a sense of pride in our Mesorah, a sense of pride in the sophistication and the depth and the nuance of our Mesorah, so the number one, that can give a child, verbally and non-verbally, the permission to ask. When they see that questions don't get pushed away, questions are responded to happily and in an age-appropriate way. Sometimes kids at a young age will ask unusually precocious questions. You're going to want to respond and respond with substance. Obviously, as with the tzitzis party, respond with substance in a way that is understandable, is age-appropriate to the child's developmental stage. But with substance, with as much substance as it can bear, and with pride in our connection to Kadosh Baruch Hu, and pride in the truth and depth of our Torah, which flows in part from the conversation we're having before about beginning to remember the sophistication of those who came before us and where it all comes from. If the same author wrote both books, the Torah and the world, if the same God who revealed himself through Torah revealed himself through the universe that he created, so we expect that things will be confluent. We expect that things will make sense. That line is sometimes attributed to Francis Bacon at the beginning of the Enlightenment, and God is the author of both books. I didn't find in Bacon, I didn't find that exact terminology in the Rambam 150 years earlier, but the concept certainly appears in the Rambam and many of his peers. A comfort and an assumption that things ought to make sense. Our religion is a religion of emes. Chosamer shal Kadosh Baruch Hu emes. It makes sense. It doesn't mean that I necessarily have all the answers. That's another key part. With pride in our Mesorah, I can make space within for a personal humility. The Gemara in Brachas, one of the very first agados in Shas, Dav Dalet Amud Aleph Maseches Brachas. Gemara gives a very important piece of advice, both from a Musa perspective and from an intellectual and philosophical perspective. Gemara says, I believe it's Rabbi Zeira, Lamed Lashon Cholomer Eini Odea. Train yourself, habituate yourself to say, I don't know. Shemetz is Bad V'Teyachez. If you always feel the need to have all the answers, sooner or later you're going to end up making something up. And it's just going to be bad. It's okay to say, I don't know. Often as parents, as teachers, as adults, we're very scared to admit lack of knowledge. Sometimes it's for l'shem shamayim reasons. We think somehow if we don't have all the answers right away, that chips away at the validity, pride of Torah. Sometimes it's for shalol l'shma reasons, because we're embarrassed to say we don't know. L'meid l'shon cholomer en yodea. Truth is far better. And humility will enable truth. If I have the humility to say, I don't have all the answers, as a matter of fact, the fact that I don't have all the answers is a far greater statement about the magnitude and depth of Torah than if I were to think that I have all the answers. As Yeshayahu reminded us, God is infinite, we're finite. We hope not to have to, but we anticipate we probably will read those words of Yeshayahu in a week from now on Shavuos B'Tammuz. Lo machshavos ha'am machshavos echem. God is infinite, we're finite. Torah is way too vast for us to have all the answers. But, let's end where we began. Das elokei avicha v'avdehu. That blend. I take pride in knowing it makes sense whether I understand or not. I begin with elokei avicha. I take it to be true based on Masorah. Just as I might appreciate the medication more if I understand the pharmacology behind it, but if I trust a doctor who prescribed it, I'll doubtlessly take the medication whether I've worked out the biochemical background or not. So I accept that there's much more out there than I understand. And at the same time, I strive to understand it. And then I can say to a child, that's a great question. I don't know either. Let's find out. Let's find out together, or let me ask someone who knows. Let's research it. There's a big, wide Torah out there. That sort of response with confidence comes from a blend, again, of pride in Masora and humility of person. And I'll close with a mashal that's close to my heart. before I became a rabbi, I was supposed to be a mathematical physicist. So I'll close with a story that maybe will speak to some of you more than others. But you don't have to care about physics to appreciate, hopefully, again, it's a mashal. So we'll close with it again. The mashal need not be true, but the idea it conveys is important. Imagine the following scenario. So you're sitting in an E&M class, an electromagnetism class, you just finished a unit on optics, Snell's law, and so on and so forth, talk about refraction and color, and now one of the problems in your problem set for the week is, given the data you have about the chemical composition of the atmosphere and about sunlight, and given what you know about the principles of optics, compute the color of the sky, which you ought to be able to do. If you know enough, you should figure out what's going to be the wavelength of visible light that's going to come through, and we'll know what color we see. And you sit down, and you set up your equations, and you plug in the numbers, and you come out to a final wavelength, and you check your table. That way, it corresponds to green. The color of the sky is green. You're probably not going to conclude that the sky is green. So you go back and redo your computations, still comes out the same. You go back, set up the equations again, still comes out the same. So you probably won't come to the conclusion that the color of the sky is green. You probably will come to the conclusion that I'm missing some piece of information. There's more to optics than what I know, and we need to do some more investigating. It doesn't mean that the investigation is purposeless. The investigation is incredibly powerful for two reasons. Number one, because that sort of investigation can lead to new understanding of other areas as well, and that's true in Torah as well. And number two, because if you have that sense of the aesthetic sense, appreciation of mathematical elegance, you'll enjoy the blueness of the sky, which hopefully we'll see tomorrow, if not today, that much more if you understand why it's blue. So both to be able to understand other areas, to apply understanding to other areas of Torah, and to appreciate the beauty of Torah, inquiry is incredibly valuable and important. We should be comfortable with it within the context of Da'as al Ke'avicha, understanding that we have the intellectual humility to realize that there's more out there than we understand. We have a pride in God who gave us the Torah and the Chachamim and Sarah who passed it on. That pride and humility join together to give us the ability to answer with confidence and to answer with the assurance that there is sophistication that we're glad to look at together, to proactively share our awareness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, our sophisticated pride in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whenever possible. And to put that all together to achieve the end of the pasuk through this yediyas Elokei Avinu, to accomplish for ourselves and for those around us greater and greater attainments of avdei b'leiv shalom of nefesh chafetza. Thank you so much. I'm glad to take questions, but maybe we'll, in deference to the next speaker, we'll take questions outside. Thank you so much.